5 days in this economy, 6 minutes. We will recap, of course. A little bit more on the relief package as well. And yes, fine, Netflix and chill, but what's your password? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is a Friday in the middle of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are going to do some specifics of the week that was in the next 6 or so minutes of live radio. Then some big picture themes, if we might. Kate Davidson's at the Wall Street Journal. David Gura is here as well. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Kate, I want to start with some reporting that you and some colleagues did at the Journal this week, a survey that the paper did of economists about growth in this economy this year. Almost 6% was the consensus, I think. First of all, correct me if I'm wrong. But second of all, it is so, so different from our experience recovering from the Great Recession. It's kind of wild.
It's really amazing. It's the roaring 20s. That's what we're in for. No, I mean, if you think about the long, slow, kind of sluggish recovery of the past decade, clearly policymakers wanted to do everything they could to avoid that. It was almost like their singular goal. And even though the economy was poised for some pretty strong growth this year, as we knew vaccines were rolling out, consumer sentiment is up, we can kind of see it starting already. This bill is really a huge insurance policy around that. So yeah, you mentioned almost 6% growth. That's what economists we surveyed, that's what they project. That's, you know, trillions of dollars more in the economy this year. CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, they were saying before the bill, we might see 3.7%. So that's a huge bump. And all that means that we might see a little bit higher inflation at the end of the year. But, you know, I think the big takeaway is really when it comes to the economy, this bill will get American businesses and households past the pandemic and then some.
Let me turn then to David Gura and that inflation thing. We got the CPI this week. David, headline was 1.7% in February from a year earlier. Core was 1.3%, vanishingly far from where the Fed wants it to be, which is symmetrically around 2%. Plenty of demand for government debt. The 10-year Treasury had an auction this week. Lots of people buying. You buying into this inflation thing?
I'm not personally, but I do think it's something that the Fed is going to continue to keep an eye on. There's a meeting coming up, and I'm sure that's something that the Fed chair, Jay Powell, is going to be asked about at that meeting. And you've seen the debate. We've all read pieces on both sides about what's going to happen here. It seems to me that the consensus as it's coalescing is around the need to do something and do more in light of what happened the last time we went through a financial crisis. And yes, there are voices of concern, voices worried about what might happen here. It seems like they're in the minority to me as I listen to all of them. And again, I think it's something that the Fed's going to keep an eye on, in addition to what you're talking about, the way that we've seen the bonds behave over the course of the last week. That'll be something else they'll be looking at as well. But I think in the end, from what we see in this package, it seems like that side, that voice of opposition, certainly didn't win out.
Yeah. Kate, let me talk thematically here for a little bit for the rest of the time that we have. And I want to talk, first of all, about the article that Neil Irwin had in the New York Times this week that I mentioned briefly the other day. His basic thesis was that with these trillions of dollars in fiscal relief coming from the Congress, the center of gravity, if you will, of decision making in this economy is shifting from Jay Powell and the Fed to lawmakers. What do you make of that?
I think it's absolutely right. And it goes back to the first question you asked, which is just the huge contrast with the last recovery that we saw after the last crisis. I mean, I can still remember as a young reporter in Washington, being up on the Hill watching Ben Bernanke practically begging Congress, please help us. You know, we can't do it all. And lawmakers really just pressuring the Fed, you know, you need to do more. We kind of, for better or worse, can't get our act together. I mean, obviously you had the Tea Party, there were a lot of dynamics at play, but they, you know, they did some stuff initially, but then it kind of petered out and it was up to the Fed. Clearly, again, this time there has been a shift. I mean, Congress, even though at times it had seemed like, you know, what are they doing up there? When are they going to pass something? They've authorized almost $6 trillion over the past year in relief. So yeah, it's pretty huge. I think that some people would say they learned their lesson.
David, a different but equally large thematic question for you. This relief bill that passed has a lot of stuff in there that indicates to me anyway, and I'm asking you because I'd be curious as to your thoughts, that this is a push back into the economy for the government in the social safety net, in healthcare, and a lot of things that had been pushed out in recent decades.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that when you look at this bill, there's a recognition of the fact that there are immediate needs to try to get the economy back to where it was. So you see things that target that, and certainly having these direct payments, an additional round of direct payments is part of that. But you're right, there's a lot in here that kind of fortifies the social safety net more broadly. I'm thinking here in particular of the child tax credit being up to $3,600 per child per year. I mean, that's substantial and has the potential to really change the system more broadly. Same is true, I think, of sort of dealing with housing insecurity and food insecurity as well. This is a big piece of legislation. I remember the last time I was on, you were asking me to sort of game out where I thought they'd end up at the end of all this. And I wasn't shy about saying I think it would have been north of $1 trillion. In fact, you know, it is. It's almost $2 trillion. You know, unsurprisingly, it was really partisan. It has no Republican support. And what's emerged here is a landmark piece of legislation. I think the Democrats broadly recognize that this was Joe Biden's first bill. They wanted it to be big, and lo and behold, it is. But you're right. It is certainly bigger and different than the past pieces of legislation that we've seen since, you know, since this crisis began a year ago. It is dealing with more, and dealing with more in kind of a long-termist way.
Yeah. All right, Kate, super quick. I'm going to have to forego the stock market is not the economy question that I wanted to ask. Ran out of time.
Can you hear me? We know the answer.
I dodged a bullet. But look, David mentioned the Fed is meeting next week, sir. We're going to end with our favorite game show on this program. Five words or less. What is Jay Powell thinking? Kate Davidson, go.
Thank God they did it.
Thank God they did it. That's good. That's five, man. Wow. And right off the top of your head, too. Okay, David, hit it. You got 10 seconds. Go.
New forecast inflation. Wait.
Oh. All right. That's four.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think Kate is better. I think Kate wins this round. We should do some kind of bracket on this game. All right. We're going to go.
David. I'm never good at this, I must say.
David, yeah, speaking at length, I think, is your forte, my friend. David Gura and Kate Davidson, thanks you too. Have a nice weekend.
You'll be discharged. Bye,
thanks, guys.
Oh, man. On Wall Street today, another split decision. Less split, really, than the last couple of sessions, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, so picking up on part of the conversation that Kate and David and I were just having about how much there is in that relief package for so many parts of this economy. $28.6 billion for restaurants, food trucks, and bars? Well, that ain't nothing. The Restaurant Revitalization Fund is a little bit like the Paycheck Protection Program. We've been telling you about that. But it does have at least one key difference, Marketplace's Kristen Schwab explains.
PPP loans came with some rules. For the money to be forgiven, a good portion had to go to payroll. Beth Gruich owns four bistros in Denver. She says she couldn't safely bring enough people into work to meet the requirements. So
we had, you know, essentially paid our employees to stay home.
She'd like to have spent some of the loan on her outdoor dining setup. That's her plan if she gets a grant. It's not a loan from the Restaurant Revitalization Fund. How much businesses qualify for is an easy equation. 2019 gross receipts minus 2020 receipts minus any PPP. And Sean Kennedy at the National Restaurant Association says certain types of businesses will be prioritized.
The first 21 days are going to be set aside specifically for women or veteran-owned businesses or people in socially and economically disadvantaged businesses.
And $5 billion will go to restaurants that made $500,000 or less in 2019. Kennedy hopes this means funding will be divided more equitably. But
there's a very good chance that demand is going to outstrip need.
Melissa Flyshoot at the New York State Restaurant Association says restaurants are in a big hole. They're overdue on rent.
As far as clearing up that mountain of debt from the last year and trying to help them feel like they can start over, this is really what they need.
Since the start of the pandemic, 110,000 restaurants have closed long-term or permanently. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Goldman Sachs was out with a report the other day. It was more of an announcement with some data attached, actually. Goldman is going to commit $10 billion over the next decade by repairing, or starting to repair, I guess, in its words, the dual and disproportionate race and gender biases that black women face. As for the data, Goldman says there is a 90% gap between the wealth of black households, where women are often the primary wage earner, and the wealth of white households. Marketplace's Erica Barris has the story.
Goldman Sachs has had initiatives for women in small businesses before, but this past year, black women dying of COVID and disproportionately losing jobs, the killing of George Floyd led to this initiative, says Asahi Pompei, head of corporate engagement at Goldman Sachs.
We knew we had to do something as it related to black women.
So the idea is to help black women get access to money and advance in the workforce, investing in things like broadband and childcare in black neighborhoods, and to partner with organizations such as Power Rising that have already been doing this work. Leah Daughtry is with the nonprofit.
Too often, organizations that want to do things in our communities do them without talking to the people who are most affected.
Initiatives like this sometimes forget it's not just money women need, says Rhonda Von Shea Sharp with the Women's Institute for Science, Equity, and Race.
Okay, Goldman, you've put in $10 billion. Are you really going to be sharing your network?
Whenever there are initiatives that focus on marginalized groups, black women tend to be left behind. Wharton professor Stephanie Creary says companies often focus on race or gender.
The categories that they have to report to the U.S. government about what they're doing with respect to understanding and advancing these groups that have historically been underrepresented and disadvantaged is race or gender.
But Creary says when a company like Goldman Sachs does something, its competitors do it too. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we basically jumped 5 years into the future.
Grocery shopping as time traveling. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials added 293 points today, 0.9%, closed at 32,778, another all-time high. The NASDAQ dropped 78 points, just about 0.6%, finished at 13,319. The S&P 500 up 4 points, 0.1%, 3,943, also another all-time high. For the week, the Dow up 4%, the NASDAQ gained just a bit more than 3%, S&P 500 added 0.2%. If you're planning to go out driving this weekend, gallon of regular gas is going to run you $2.83 on average. That's according to AAA. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note. Get a load of this. Up to 1.62%. And you are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The pandemic comes along. We all hunkered down, desperate to pass the time. And what do? Why, yes, we grab the remote. We flip on the streaming service of our choice. And while away the hours, many of us using passwords that, well, shall we just say that we're not necessarily paying for, borrowing, perhaps, from friends or family. Some Netflix subscribers have been getting a pop-up warning the past couple of days. If you don't live with the owner of this account, it says, you need your own account to keep watching. And that is just, well, here's Sabri Benishore.
Oh, my God. No, I have to call some. I got to go. I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace. Okay. For real, though, a lot of people share their passwords.
My name is Lauren. I live in Philadelphia, and I shared my HBO Max username and password with my girlfriend, Sarah.
I'm Sarah. I got Lauren's HBO password, and then I gave the HBO password to my friend, Dan. He's in Delaware.
I'm Dan, and I shared my Disney Plus with Sarah in a trade.
For some, like John in New York, it's a family tradition.
Two of my cousins, my best friend, and my sister, and then my cousin's kids are all using my Netflix.
Sharing is caring, but it's also technically piracy and is 100% against the terms of service. And piracy of all kinds cost streaming companies around $9 billion in 2019, according to Parks Associates, where Steve Nason is research director. But he says it's not usually a top priority for streaming companies.
even those people that are sharing passwords, at least they're getting exposed to the service.
But you might see actual crackdowns in the future by streaming companies just because there are so many platforms. James McQuivy is with Forrester Research.
People aren't going to pay five or six different services. Password sharing may become a default long-term experience. And if they're already seeing that in their data, then they're going to crack down on it.
For now, though, sharing seems to be kind of safe. A source familiar with Netflix's plan says the company is just testing to learn about how its users watch and not enforcing anything for now. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
There was a conversation in my house the other day. Participants shall remain nameless to preserve domestic tranquility, but it went something like this. What do you want to do once you get your shots? I want to go to the grocery store without worrying about it. Now, does that match you? Or, like a whole lot of people, have you gone online and you are going to stay there for your groceries? A lot of supermarkets are assuming the e-grocery trend, which has, to be clear, been around for years, but really took off during the pandemic. Supermarkets are thinking that trend is going to continue, and they are investing accordingly. Marketplace Scott Tong reminds us that having our groceries picked for us is, in a way, kind of a return to the past.
A century ago, grocery shopping was handing a list to a clerk who fetched everything, and we paid. Then in 1916, modernity came. The first self-serve supermarket, a Piggly Wiggly shop in Memphis.
So here I'm at my grocery store, doing things pretty much the way we've been doing them since Woodrow Wilson was president, walking around grabbing stuff. Trash bags. All right, bananas. Okay, that took 48 minutes. That's a lot of time.
When COVID came, supermarkets weren't just a time suck. They became a germ risk. So many of us shopped online, and it stuck. Mitch Hayes at the automation firm Swiss Log Logistics says industry data show that if you order online once and then twice, you're probably hooked.
The chance that you're going to order a third time, that number grows very quickly, above 80%. So the adoption rate has just exploded.
Now, supermarkets often have more online orders than they can handle, with employees roaming the aisles and picking. So one solution? A new kind of clerk, robot clerks, like in this warehouse in Brooklyn run by the robotics company Fabric. There are no aisles, just stacks of bins, 80 rows long and 12 stories high. And gliding between them are 20 short squat robots that look like those Roomba vacuums.
Which are the ones that climb up and down and sideways in the aisles and grab the totes.
Steve Horniak is Fabric's chief commercial officer.
And then you've got the ground robots. Hundreds of tiny little conveyor systems fulfilling orders, you know, like ants.
Eventually, a bin full of, say, milk arrives at a station where a person grabs one milk and puts it in a shopping bag. The warehouse can fill 1,000 online orders a day. That's 10 times what a regular store can. Now, before the pandemic, just 5% of grocery orders were online. That's doubled.
We had not expected to see 10 to 12% penetration until 2025. We basically jumped almost 5 years into the future.
Thing is, some of us like to go to the store, right? To pick our produce? John Lert, whose company Alert Innovation makes robots for retail firms, says, sure, part of the store can stay the same, but the boring stuff in the center aisles? Automate that.
I don't think many customers really value the center store experience once I've decided I want a, you know, box of Post Raisin Bran. I don't go looking for the very best looking box.
The challenge for supermarkets is how to pay for these warehouses that can cost $5 million apiece.
They can't raise prices because of competitive pressures and price sensitivity of customers. How do you capture all this demand that's surging, but how do you make money on doing that?
One way to save money is to build automated warehouses in low-cost, unused spaces. These are called dark stores, says Jordan Burke, founder of Tomorrow Retail Consulting.
There are dark stores in everything from old fitness clubs to parking decks to even residential buildings that were vacant.
Another cost saver, subbing robots for people.
That's dicey, though. Several supermarkets we tried declined to talk.
Employees are going to wonder what the future looks like, particularly as more of the basic tasks in a store are automated.
Burke says there will be grocery jobs in the future. It's just hard to know exactly what they'll look like, because the big chains are all investing in robots. Walmart, Albertsons, Kroger. He thinks in a couple years, we'll get our groceries delivered in 30 minutes. That is a fast clerk. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The Democratic majorities in both houses of Congress are pretty thin. Can't get no thinner in the Senate, right? And that helps explain why Democrats are talking about bringing back a much maligned but once popular congressional tool. Earmarks, specific line items inserted into ginormous spending bills that let members of Congress direct specific funding to specific projects that they can take specific credit for back home. They were banned, earmarks were, back in 2011 after some high-profile scandals. So Marketplace's Kimberly Adams went to figure out why they might be coming back.
Earmarks became something of a dirty word at the height of their use, thanks in part to loud complaints from small government groups.
So if you go back to the early 1990s, you had about 3,000 earmarks in the spending bills that fund government. By 2005, there were more than 15,000 earmarks that were funding government.
Steve Ellis runs Taxpayers for Common Sense and says that old system left a lot of openings for abuse.
Anytime you've got money that's able to be thrown around, you're going to have lobbyists that are going to try to get that cash on behalf of their client.
Being anti-earmark became a key theme for Republicans. Ellis's group identified and nicknamed the infamous Bridge to Nowhere, a regular target in the stump speech of 2008 vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin.
I told Congress, thanks, but no thanks for that Bridge to Nowhere up in Alaska.
But before Palin and other lawmakers said no to earmarks, they said yes. A lot, because many earmarks met community needs. Sandy Washington runs the nonprofit group Lifestyles, Inc., which provides homeless services in Maryland. The group actually got one of the last earmarks before they were banned.
I'm trying to think. 60,000 was when we started over here. We moved into this building.
Lifestyles used that money to set up a new homeless services center with computer stations, warming centers, a food pantry, laundry room, and showers. Volunteer coordinator Tammy Gosman gives me a tour, pointing out the family showers in particular.
And I can imagine if I was homeless and the only way I was getting in a shower would be to close the door between me and my babies, and I probably wouldn't get that shower, so...
Another big reason why proponents want to bring back earmarks is because they say they'll make Congress more productive by giving members more incentive to compromise.
Particularly for folks who are expecting a close reelection fight and want to credit claim that they got something important for their district.
Laura Blessing is at Georgetown's Government Affairs Institute. She says earmarks were only ever a small slice of the federal budget, and
a lot of these things are, you know, for projects that are needed, but just couldn't get placed into a larger bill, particularly in a more gridlocked Congress.
Blessing's research shows that since the earmark ban, getting spending bills through the House, tough even in the best of times, basically became impossible. And for small nonprofits like Lifestyles in Maryland, which received a total of about $660,000 in earmarks before the ban,
it was kind of devastating.
Proposed rules for the return of earmarks include stricter limits and more transparency. But in the meantime, Washington already has a plan for her first request if earmarks do come back.
Because we're here. We're at ground zero. And we know what we need in our communities.
And at the moment, that need for her group is $700,000 to finish the new homeless shelter they're working on. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, about which I kid you not, the Spartans of Michigan State University, long a stalwart of Division I men's basketball, though not doing real great this year. They've announced an expansion of an endorsement contract they've got with Rocket Mortgage. It's a 5-year deal, which, among other things, will have the men's basketball team identified in its home arena as, and this is the I kid you not part, as the MSU Spartans presented by Rocket Mortgage. So go MSU Spartans presented by Rocket Mortgage. All right, we got to go. A little jam-packed today, so no moment of economic context for you. Apologies. Our theme music was composed by, yes, BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourselves a great weekend, everybody. All right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.